Good afternoon, I'm Kathy Lewis. The first presidential debate of this cycle is in the history books, and we're opening our phones today to get your reaction. Did you hear anything that changed your mind or something that solidified your selection? We'll check in with Professor Rachel Bitticofer, whose expertise is political polarization. Just a guess here, but I suspect we still have a fair amount of that this afternoon. We'll also talk with the head of the best college debate team in the world about the construct of debate in the modern era and whether there are some other types of formats that might be more illuminating. And we'll talk with a producer with Frontline, whose latest effort is a dual biography of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, told by the people who know them best. A great show is ahead after this news. Good afternoon. I'm Kathy Lewis. It's good to have you with us today. The presidential debate last night had one of the highest viewerships of such debates on record. And so we're opening our phones today to hear what you have to say about it. We're at 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. We're also going to be debriefing the debate with Samuel Nelson, who's the head of the best debate team in college. How about that? Well, he'll be with us in just a moment. Mike Weiser will be with us as well from Frontline. He's done a very, very interesting piece called The Choice 2016, and it's a dual biography of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and it goes back to the stories that shaped them as people, and the stories are told by people who know them best. So that's going to be a very, very interesting program that's going to be on WHRO TV 15 tonight at 9 o'clock. We're at 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. Before we get started, though, I also want to let you know that I have, through a lovely friend who is very generous, come across a set of tickets. Well, it makes it sound like I picked them off the ground. That is not the case. But we are very happy to have a set of tickets to hear Shark Tank star Barbara Corcoran in Norfolk tonight. She's coming to the Norfolk Forum at Chrysler Hall to share her expertise on entrepreneurship. It starts at 7:30 tonight. These are tickets that somebody paid for, but they are free to you if you want to give us a call at 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. I don't know if you're aware, but just in case you aren't, that the Norfolk Forum is the oldest publicly subscribed speakers forum in the country, and it was founded in 1933. They bring about four speakers or so in a year, and Barbara Corcoran is the first. She is terrific. I think you'll really enjoy her. Then coming up on October 25th, it's Tucker Carlson and James Carville, political correspondents or political commentators, I should say. And that's going to be just a few days before the election, so that should be interesting. Sully Sullenberg will also be coming in on January 17th for the Norfolk Forum, and retired Army General Stanley McChrystal coming in on the 21st of March. And so there you go. TheNorfolkForum.org is where you can learn more about the other events, but I do have two tickets, 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240, and those are for tonight's presentation by Barbara Corcoran, getting underway at 7:30 at Chrysler Hall. Well, the phones are blowing up, as they do when we open them for this kind of conversation. We are glad to have in the studio with us today Rachel Bitticofer, who's a lecturer and director of Christopher Newport University's Survey Research Lab at the Judy Ford Wasson Center for Public Policy. And her particular expertise is presidential elections, political behavior, and political polarization. You hit a trifecta last night. Professor, nice to have you with us today.
I sure did. Thank you so much for having me, Kathy.
Yeah, you're welcome. So let me ask first, obviously you watched the whole thing because political scientists do that, right?
I did.
Did you watch all the run-up, the breathless commentary before the event?
Well, normally I would partake in all of the run-up, but yeah. I was proud to be hosting our CNU watch party for our students Gene Theater, so I was unable to do so.
Got it. Okay. Mm-hmm. So as a student of presidential elections, presidential behavior, political behavior, and polarization, Give us a couple of your key takeaways from last night, your key observations from the debate.
Yeah, so I think we really need to point out is that, you know, Clinton went into that debate with really high expectations, and Trump went into the debate with low expectations. And Clinton met that bar, right? She did very well. And even though the bar was low for Trump, he failed to meet it, right? So we have a situation in which we don't usually have. We have pretty decisive winner from that debate. Certainly, if you were to look in Trump's ardent support base and of course, the surrogates, you'll hear a different narrative. But the takeaway is that Clinton had a very good night and Trump struggled. It was definitely a result of the lack of preparation on his part.
There is the one particular moment. Well, there were several moments, but this one particular moment seems to be a real focus this morning. And it is a moment that refers to both Secretary Clinton's emails and Donald Trump's tax returns. Let's listen.
So you've got to ask yourself, why won't he release his tax returns? And I think there may be a couple of reasons. First, maybe he's not as rich as he says he is. Second, maybe he's not as charitable as he claims to be. Third, we don't know all of his business dealings, but we have been told through investigative reporting that he owes about $650 million to Wall Street and foreign banks. Or maybe he doesn't want the American people, all of you watching tonight, to know that he's paid nothing in federal taxes, because the only years that anybody's ever seen were a couple of years when he had to turn them over to state authorities when he was trying to get a casino license, and they showed he didn't pay any federal income tax. So
that makes
if he's
smart.
Paid zero, that means zero for troops, zero for vets, zero for schools or health. And I think probably he's not all that enthusiastic about having the rest of our country see what the real reasons are, because it must be something really important, even terrible, that he's trying to hide. And the financial disclosure statement, they don't give you the tax rate. They don't give you all the details that tax returns would. And it just seems to me that this is something that the American people deserve to see. And I have no reason to believe that he's ever going to release his tax returns, because there's something he's hiding. And we'll guess. We'll keep guessing at what it might be that he's hiding. But I think the question is, were he ever to get near the White House, what would be those conflicts? Who does he owe money to? Well, he owes you the answers to that, and he should provide them.
I will release my tax returns against my lawyer's wishes. When she releases her 33,000 emails that have been deleted, as soon as she releases them, I will release my tax returns. And that's against my lawyers. They say, don't do it. I will tell you this. No, in fact, watching shows, reading the papers, almost every lawyer says, you don't release your returns until the audit's complete. When the audit's complete, I'll do it. But I would go against them if she releases her emails.
14 minutes past the hour. It seems to me, Professor Bitticoffer, this is the exchange that about which there has been much conversation this morning.
Yes, and this is one of Clinton's most powerful moments in the debate. A lack of preparation on the Trump campaign's part is, frankly, as a campaign strategist expert, slightly baffling. You would have expected this question to come up. The response that he was giving is the standard response that surrogates give on the stump, but clearly he should have known he would need a better answer. And the snide comment that it makes him smart not to pay federal taxes probably didn't resonate well with your average American.
We're at 15 minutes past the hour. It's 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. And those are the numbers where you can join us today. Alan is on the line from Chesapeake. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Hello, Kathy. Thank you for taking my call. The first thing, when I watched the debate on YouTube last night, the first thing I noticed was Hillary in what seemed to be a Nancy Reagan red pantsuit and Donald Trump with a Democratic blue tie on.
It's an interesting style point, Alan, and I thank you for the call. I don't know how much thought goes into this wardrobe thing, although it seems like there are many other issues that we could talk about as well.
Well, actually, quite a lot of thought does tend to go into that. And like Alan, I noticed that right off the bat as soon as they entered the stage or really entered the building. So it was an interesting choice. And I think somebody in the theater I was watching the debate made the crack that they're already trying to confuse us.
15 minutes past the hour. So we had the first what we're calling a debate last night. But if you are a student of debate, maybe you were a debater in high school or college, this debate and all of the presidential debates are not like classic debates are. Nobody knows that better than Samuel Nelson. He directs forensics and is a senior lecturer in labor relations, law, and history at Cornell University. He has the winningest debate team in the world. Well done. Samuel Nelson, thank you for being with us today.
Yeah, that title of winningest debate team is, of course, debatable like everything else.
Like everything else.
Yes.
But I wonder if we can talk for a moment about this format issue, because there's an interesting aspect to that when we think about how candidates do in different kinds of formats.
Yeah, and the big thing, the big difference between the kind of debate I teach at Cornell when we go to a competition and a public debate, which what this is that how you define a winner. And I think the way you define a winner is whether or not the perception overall is that you met expectations. And just like the professor said before me, I feel like Hillary Clinton met her expectations, probably exceeded them in some ways, and Donald Trump did not.
You say that President Ronald Reagan was one of the best debaters in politics because of his ability to keep his cool, and there is much conversation about that this morning. We are in this 24-hour news environment where everything these candidates say and do is on the air pretty quickly. That seems to be a tough thing to do, and if you mess that up, it can have resonating consequence.
Right, and I think a key moment in last night's debate was when Donald Trump started to lose it a little bit, and I think he realized it, and then he started quickly pivoting to the issue of Hillary Clinton's temperament. And I actually think that backfired on him because I think it drew more attention to the fact that he was losing control.
17 minutes past the hour. You know, the other thing I was wondering about, Professor Nelson, is this role of the moderator. And boy, I tell you what, that is a thankless job if ever there were one. And it seems to me that we expect a lot out of these people, and Candy Crowley was criticized for being too intrusive, but then there was a question about whether Matt Lauer had fact-checked enough, and then Lester Holt last night, according to some accounts, was too hands-off. I wonder if you talk about the role of the moderator and how we might construct these debates in a way that might be more illuminating.
I actually think Lester Holt didn't do that bad of a job. I actually think it would be better for everybody involved if we got the focus off the moderator and left it up to the candidates to point out each other's flaws or when they get off target or perhaps when they're not stating things quite truthfully. Let's let the debaters debate. Let's keep the moderator out of it. We have a long history of political debates in this country, and usually the moderator just basically keeps time and points out that, you know, maybe reads the questions for the next segment, but we don't really need a journalist. I think it's an impossible job, as you said before, you know, a journalist put in the middle of all this.
You know, and I wonder as well, there's been this big question about fact checking. And in fact, Bloomberg, I think, was the last night fact checked live. The other network said it's a little too much to expect. But Bloomberg actually did fact check live. And so, you know, I wonder about that in the construct of this moderator question. It seems like that's a lot to keep up with, to your point.
Absolutely. And we have new technology now. It's possible for Bloomberg to do exactly what they did, and we'll just get better at it and better at it as the technology advances. If people want to check the facts literally simultaneously as the debate is going on, it's possible to do that now because of the ever-increasing speed of our ability to harness technology. So I don't think we need the moderator playing that role as well.
So I wonder, there's been conversation as well about a moderatorless debate, you know, just sort of letting the candidates go at it and talk with each other themselves. What are the positives and negatives of that?
Well, I think I'm really for this. And I think the main positive is we get to see how the candidate deals with someone that they don't agree with. This is and how they handle, you know, quote unquote, awkward situations. This is important for the next president of the United States. Not everybody they deal with, not every meeting they go into goes exactly as scripted. So we get to see them in uncomfortable positions. That's an important thing.
That's a really interesting point because I was thinking about the fact that it also would give you a window into how they actually deal with other people in an unmoderated sort of way, if you will.
Absolutely. And the other good thing about it is we can see if they can think on their feet. Each side will strategize even more so as to try to get the other one off their game. I think it would be fascinating.
You know, this is a very interesting point. We're at 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. We're talking about last night's first presidential debate, the first of three, and then there's a vice presidential debate as well. So give us a call with your thoughts when you hear somebody hang up. Debbie's on the line from Chesapeake. Hi, Debbie. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
As a political junkie, I could talk for an hour on this, but I just had heard somewhere to mute it for a little bit and just look at their body language. And if you looked at Donald Trump's face, he was just making the most grimaced faces and painful faces. And then Hillary was trying to sit there and smile because she was criticized so much after the commander-in-chief for not smiling enough. So I thought if you just go back and mute it, and it's very clear.
You know, it's an interesting point, Debbie, and I think there's a very interesting gender conversation to be had around this. I wonder what you think about that, Professor Bitticoff.
Yeah, and this should have been a predictable challenge, especially for Trump. I mean, this is a well-known debate, you know, staple. You have to control your expressions while the other person is talking, especially given that you're debating the first female candidate for the president of the United States. That brings its own challenges, especially given Trump's, you know, fairly bombastic style. So to have seen that, you know, beyond the first 15 minutes, absolutely no control over what viewers were seeing on his face. And as your caller just pointed out, one could have muted that TV, not listened to a single word said for the rest of the debate, and still come away with the conclusion that Clinton won it.
Just on the facials.
Very correct.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. We're at 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Samuel Nelson is the Director of Forensics and Senior Lecturer in Labor Relations, Law, and History at Cornell University. Professor, it seems to me that one of the other things we note in this conversation, and I think there was some Facebook commentary around this, is the idea, and Professor Bitticoff just referred to this, that if the female candidate does not smile enough, there's a problem. If she smiles too much, there's a problem. Are we getting to the point where we are more accustomed to seeing more diversity, that we're changing our attitudes about that?
I think sometimes we forget Hillary Clinton is the first presidential candidate in this kind of situation, you know, in a record-breaking televised presidential debate. I believe that we're witnessing history. She will blaze the trail for future female candidates. And I also believe that we live sort of in a world of double standards, where we apply different measures of good and bad for candidates, especially things like body language, depending on their gender.
25 minutes past the hour. You know, it's very interesting, too, because so much of the commentary this morning has been around the perception of who, quote unquote, won. And Samuel Nelson, you say that's really a key differentiator here. It's in terms of what we're looking for out of these debates.
Right. There's been a lot of research that says that very few people, despite what they may say when they're polled, actually decide who they're going to vote for based on the debates. What actually happens is people find out reasons why they're going to vote the way they're going to vote. They parrot back things they hear in the debates to their friends and therefore exercise influence in that way, among their friends, among their social circles. And so I think it was a strong performance. Hillary Clinton gave lots of reasons for her supporters and potential supporters to share with their friends, whereas Donald Trump didn't do that so much.
Samuel Nelson, I want to thank you so much for joining us today from Cornell University. This question of moderator focus and a different kind of format is one I suspect we will continue to debate in this cycle and beyond. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. Samuel Nelson is the director of forensics and a senior lecturer in labor relations, law, and history at Cornell University. We're at 25 minutes past the hour. It's 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. You can also join us on Facebook. That's an easy thing to do. Just surf on over to our Hearsay Facebook page. You can also make your comments on Twitter. It's at Kathy Lewis Talks, and we'd love to hear from you. On Facebook, Jim writes, I watched, despite most of what I'm reading this morning, I thought Trump won, and I predict Clinton will continue to fall in the polls. People are fed up with the status quo and the media telling them what and how to think. For the record, he says, my guy wasn't invited. Hashtag let Gary debate. I think this is a really interesting, interesting post, Professor, because the fact of the matter is people can view this and one wonders whether people who are in one camp or in another camp will come out of it differently. It really seems that the battle was for the undecideds.
Well, yeah, so that's what I would caution is, you know, what we're thinking about in terms of won the debate, or at least what I'm thinking about when I think about one debate is, okay, we've got these two candidates. They're, you know, fairly close together in the polls. They've got their strident supporters, and now we have this pile of undecided voters who will ultimately decide which is going to prevail on election day. So to win the debate, the goal is to cajole or persuade that camp in particular. I think Clinton did that, right? She reached out to those moderate Republicans, especially women, suburbanite women, with a reminder of Trump's, sketchy history about women, and persuaded national security-minded Republicans even, but certainly independents, that she would be a more reliable or steady-as-you-go candidate or option for them. Trump, on the other hand, spoke directly to his ardent supporters, and so I'm not surprised to find, you know, you reading the Facebook message from a supporter of Trump saying, yes, you know, this is exactly what I like about Trump, and that is what he delivered. But unfortunately, what he needed to do is try to reach out to those undecided moderate voters, and I don't feel he did that.
You know, it strikes me, too, we are talking about this in the run-up to November 8th, but that perspective, which is shared by a number of people about being so unhappy with the status quo, deep dissatisfaction with government, deep dissatisfaction with these choices. That is going to be with us on November 9th.
Oh, absolutely. As the Wasson Center poll found that we just released yesterday, I mean, the electorate is not excited about the election. We see in public opinion data, ours and others, that voters are, you know, voting against the other candidate, not necessarily for their own candidate. Of course, there are exceptions in that. So, you know, this actually, the conditions of the race really favored Donald Trump insofar as him being an outsider candidate. And the fact that he's not winning, it really does show that the campaign has made strategic errors.
The debate, but the fact that the polling looks very, very close.
Well,
yes?
The polling is close, but it's certainly not as close as one would expect. I mean, look at Virginia. Virginia is supposed to be the epicenter of this election cycle. And, you know, we would think of it now as a lean Democratic state for Hillary Clinton.
Let's go to Daryl, who's been on the line for a long time from Newport News. Thank you, Daryl, for holding.
Kathy, always enjoy the program.
Thank you.
Two quick points. I wish these debates, they would have some sort of a baseline of information, sort of a cheat sheet. In other words, talking about taxes and his tax return, roughly, and y'all correct me if I'm wrong, roughly 50% of Americans pay little or nothing in federal tax. So he's not required, and point two, there's no requirement that you have to divulge your tax return any more than Obama is not required to divulge his birth certificate. It's strange, but tell me if I'm wrong.
So, Daryl,
hang
on one second. Let's keep Daryl in the conversation there. Daryl, the question I wonder about is, You have the concern that's been expressed around the disclosure of the tax returns, because you're right, there's not a requirement to do it, but it has been the practice for many, many election cycles in modern history. And I wonder, the concern about it is, what connections do the candidates have to foreign companies, to foreign governments? How vulnerable may they be? Or conversely, to what degree may decisions they make affect their own investments? And I've not yet seen a poor person run in recent memory for the presidency. So they all have sort of very complex financial dealings. And I guess my question is, do you want to know that? Are you comfortable not knowing that?
It's actually, whether it's, I am a conservative, being a friend, it frankly doesn't bother me, because all of these individuals, unfortunately, were stuck with lawyers and very wealthy people that run for president. They're all going to have international connections or business dealings or whatnot. Certainly, I'd prefer he release it. But, you know, it does seem one-sided to me. It really does, that Obama, and I'm not trying to get off track, but Obama is not required to release his birth certificate. Man's born in Kenya or
well, I think that's
Kenya,
been
whatever. So
I think that's
why
been
isn't
debunked,
that more of a media, or, you know, I think you can find a subject on any of these candidates, that's any candidate. And this is bothersome to me, that yes, he should return it, but it should be pointed out he's not required to return it anymore.
Yeah, Daryl, you're 100% correct that he is not required to release his income tax, and I think that has actually been reported, as have the debunking of the birth certificate issue with regard to President Obama. But the question, and this is, you bring up a great point, there are things that we are required to do, we being all of us who run for president, wait, nobody in this room is, the people who are candidates are required to disclose, and then things that they are sort of expected to disclose. And I wonder, Professor, as you think about this debate over the tax returns, it's a policy. Do you think it's a practice. Do you think it should be a policy?
I think perhaps we should, after this election cycle, consider making it, you know, a requirement. But, you know, I would say to your viewer who is comfortable with, you know, Trump's decision not to disclose, to, you know, question whether or not he would feel the same way if Clinton had decided not to disclose her tax return. You know, in general, I think when we try to apply some universal rule, we see things a little differently.
27 minutes before the hour, Anne is on the line from Portsmouth. Hi, Anne, you're on the air.
Hi, and my question basically was for the debate coach there. During the debate, there was a lot of, Trump seemed to go on and on and on and on. And my concern is, without a moderator, would that just continue? And would the other person, whoever it is, be able to get their word in edgewise? Or would you have this talking over each other?
It's a great point, Anne. It's a great point and a great question.
Yeah, so I think I could speak to that a little bit. In fact, the format of the debate, the way it was set up, the moderator is supposed to have a far more active role. Responses were supposed to be limited to 2 minutes. And, you know, professionals would look at that and say, okay, this is a format that would help a novice, right? And Donald Trump being the novice in this situation. And then, you know, Lester Holt's decision or lack of aggression in enforcing that rule, you know, it did not help Donald Trump that he was able to go on and on. That's really where he made some of the most, the worst errors that he made. And so, you know, in a format where it was a free-for-all, I'm not saying this would be a universal rule, but in general, people with less experience, like Mr. Trump, would be disadvantaged. And the last thing that the Trump campaign would strategically want is a more free-flow debate format.
Wow, 24 minutes before the hour, we're 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. We've had stacked calls for most of the hour. We do have one line available for you now. There was also some conversation around that dynamic, around the interrupting, and it was fairly consistent in segments where Secretary Clinton was to have had 2 minutes to speak about whatever the issue was. There was some pretty consistent interruption that did not go answered by the moderator. And the conversation this morning, and it's a very interesting question, is what, you know, is there a difference in the way we evaluate a female candidate's response to that as opposed to a male candidate's response? And she, you know, Mrs. Clinton did not, interrupt. Mm-hmm. And some people said she should have. And then other people said, well, if she had done that, then she would have been characterized as aggressive.
Well, we're living in an age where we quantify everything. So we happen to know, thanks to Vox, that Trump interrupted Clinton 51 times, I believe, and 17 times she interrupted him. So obviously large difference there. That was a strategic thing that the Clinton campaign prepared for. Anybody who studies Trump will know that he has a tendency to interrupt, maybe, you know, with women, but I would suspect more just in general from his time in the business world, kind of being a titan and having people under him, you get used to that. But what shocks me is that, you know, even though he didn't do mock debate preparation, it's almost like they did no debate preparation, because one thing that he should have done or should have known when it comes to gender debates, you know, where one's a man, where one's a woman, is that, you know, it's a well-known and documented fact that in a room with men and women, men tend to interrupt women. It's something he should have been extremely cautious about doing, and instead seemed to be doing it with abandon, right? And of course, it came off exactly as I expected it was while I was watching it live, interpreted as frankly rude, right?
We're 24 minutes before the hour. Jason writing, the train wreck of a debate last night shows why we need 30-party libertarian candidate Gary Johnson on the stage. Robert's on the line from Virginia Beach. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hello. Just a quick statement and then my actual point. Quick statement is, we have the technology. I really wish they'd give the moderators a mute button and maybe like a shot clock at the bottom of the screen like they do in sports. So that way, when the 2 minutes is up, you flip the mute button on, he gets to the next one, and nobody gets a mic on until it's time for them to speak.
Robert, I tell you, many people have asked that very question. Trust me, the technology is available.
And next is, I think basically when we talk about who won the debate, I think they both won, because I'm just going to use apples and oranges because it's easier. If you are leaning towards possibly maybe being an Apple candidate, he probably pushed you over the edge. She probably pushed you over the edge. If you're leaning towards being an orange candidate, then they probably pushed you over the edge. But I really don't think anybody's mind got changed last night.
Matt, thank you for the call. That sentiment is certainly expressed by some of our posters. Barry said he did watch parts of it. Now I'm totally sure who I'm voting for, our first woman president in the U.S. Deborah said, I'm on the Trump train. Bell said, yes, I watched. The debate did nothing to change my vote. So one of the questions we have for you this day, dear listeners, has to do with those of you who are undecided heading into November 8th. Did you see or hear anything last night that helped you make a decision? And I know there are quite a number of people who are contemplating a third party vote because of their dissatisfaction with the Democrat and the Republican candidate. So we're wondering how you're processing that this morning. Matt's on the line from Virginia Beach. Hi, Matt. You're on the air. Matt, go right ahead. You're on the air.
Kathy, I'm here. Thank you so much for taking my call. I guess my question to you, Kathy, it's not to Trump and it's not to Hillary, is your statement a couple minutes ago to the gentleman from Portsmouth who was talking about the legality behind Trump having to or not having to release his tax returns. And, you know, and then your response was, well, wouldn't you want him to see so you could learn if he was beholden to any companies or any.
I think what I said was, wouldn't you want any candidate to do that?
OK, well, Kathy, my question to you, and I don't want to interrupt you, and I know I'm the man on the conversation, but how would you then state your feeling as a voter, and I am an undecided voter, to all these emails that were deleted and as a voter who's undecided, if I'm going to see anything that might question national security and who you're beholden to, there's thousands of emails that were deleted that weren't released. So you, as a educated, thoughtful person, Why are we even discussing these tax returns if we're not going to discuss the emails in the same vein? Because that we know was wrong, that we know there was a lot of information that could tell us a lot about Clinton. And you're focusing on a tax return? I mean,
well, let me be clear, Matt. The question was from the listener, was about the tax return. That's one point. The second point is, I think there are all kinds of issues about which voters should be concerned. That's why we use this program to explore all those issues. There are concerns around immigration. There are concerns around national security. Certainly the email issue was discussed in the debate last night, and it continues to be discussed. In fact, here is Secretary Clinton talking about that very issue.
No, I made a mistake using a private email.
That's for sure.
If I had to do it over again, I made a mistake using a private email.
That's for sure.
And if I had to do it over again, I would obviously do it differently. But I'm not going to make any excuses. It was a mistake, and I take responsibility for that.
Mr. Trump?
That was more than a mistake. That was done purposely. Okay, that was not a mistake. That was done purposely. When you have your staff taking the Fifth Amendment, taking the Fifth, so they're not prosecuted. When you have the man that set up the illegal server taking the Fifth, I think it's disgraceful. And believe me, this country thinks it's disgraceful. It really thinks it's disgraceful also. As far as my tax returns, you don't learn that much from tax returns, that I can tell you. You learn a lot from financial disclosure. And you should go down and take a look at that. The other thing, I'm extremely under-leveraged. The report that said 650, which, by the way, a lot of friends of mine that know my business said, boy, that's really not a lot of money. It's not a lot of money relative to Roy Head. The buildings that were in question, they said in the same report, which was actually wasn't even a bad story, to be honest with you, but the buildings are worth $3.9 billion. And the 650 isn't even on that, but it's not 650. It's much less than that. But I could give you a list of banks. I would, if that would help you, I would give you a list of banks. These are very fine institutions, very fine banks. I could do that very quickly. I am very under leveraged. I have a great company. I have a tremendous income. And the reason I say that is not in a braggadocious way. It's because it's about time that this country had somebody running it that has an idea about money.
18 minutes before the hour, that's a clip from last night's debate discussing both the email situation as well as the tax return situation. Thank you for your call, Matt. Brianna's on the line from Norfolk. Hi, Brianna. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to ask if there is a way to set up a point system of how many times each candidate really proposes a solution. Last night, there was a lot of discussion from candidate Trump, with him just discussing a lot of issues, while you had Secretary Clinton mentioning all of her solutions for the questions and the problems presented.
You know, it's an interesting point, Brianna, and I think a lot of people are looking at these debate formats and yearning for something that will be just the perfect solution. I suspect that probably doesn't exist, which is why it's probably good we're having a couple of different opportunities to see these candidates, because the fact of the matter is, and we've seen this historically with debates, that in some formats, some candidates do better. Even just on a different night or a different circumstance, some candidates will do better. This is an interesting point, though, Professor Bitticofer, because Brianna's talking about, she really wants to hear about issues. And I wonder, as you analyze the format and the questions, do you think it is issue-based enough?
So it's really up to the candidates to turn it back to the issues. They have opportunities to do so. Certainly every question is kind of trying to dig at that, right? Most questions, not every question. And, you know, here's a situation where it really does come down to a very different stylistic approach to public speaking between Clinton and Trump. You know, Clinton is, you know, almost famously too detailed about policy. She goes on and on. She can sound lawyerly. I mean, these are the common criticisms you'll hear about her style, whereas Mr. Trump is much more into soaring rhetoric, much more into, you know, kind of hitting voters at that gut reaction, that gut level. That's what he does best. And in fact, you know, in the previous soundbite that we listened to, the first 5, 10, 15 seconds there, that was Trump at his most effective, prosecuting the case against Clinton on that email scandal. And if it had ended right there, it would have been termed a win. But then he goes off and just starts, you know, rambling about businesses and stuff. And what? So, yeah, I think that, you know, it really does depend on the candidates. And if you think back to 2012 and Romney, they got down in the weeds quite a bit about policy, right? But it does take two to tango in that regard. So if your viewer noticed an imbalance, I would say that imbalance is definitely there. But it's in a balance that, you know, Clinton has an advantage in.
So it's an interesting thing, too, because I think it was 2012, maybe it's 2008. They all run together after a while. You know, it's interesting to think about what the impact of the debate last night was, because in history, sometimes you can have a candidate who doesn't perform as well as may have been expected. But in the end, it may not matter as much.
Yeah, it depends. And, you know, the other professor that was on, the debate expert, was talking about, you know, the minimal effects of debates. And we do know that from the research that campaign debates do have minimal effects. They mostly reinforce partisan attitudes. You know, we're talking about 5 to 10% of the electorate that's persuadable still in a debate. But usually what we have is a situation in which we have two candidates, both of whom have government experience, you know, of some type, both of whom are coming, you know, to the debate stage after having survived, you know, a winnowing field and at least engaging in some pretty high, you know, stakes debates. But here we had a real we have a real experience imbalance. I mean, Trump had debated, of course, through the Republican primary, but never in a situation on one-on-one for 90 minutes. With nowhere to go but to talk about, you know, more detailed policy. So, you know, that would be a big difference.
David's on the line from Norfolk. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, Kathy. Thanks.
You're welcome.
How do we as voters gain more control over how the debates are put together? So, for example, right now it's, you know, you have to have a minimum of 15%, but why can't we amend that with, okay, over 15% or the top three or the top four? How do we go about, I don't know, petitioning that?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question, David, because I think if you've listened to this show for any length of time, you know there are at least a fair number of our callers are certainly concerned, and today our posters are concerned about the lack of additional candidates on that stage.
Certainly, then I would urge viewers who are concerned about that, who would like to see a different system put into place, would really have to apply pressure directly to the Commission on Presidential Debates. That's a nonpartisan outfit. It's not controlled by the parties. I can't think of a coercive method of achieving that, but with public pressure, that could be achievable. So that's what I would recommend.
David, it's a great question and certainly a lot of interest in it. 13 minutes before the hour, we're glad to have Mike Weiser with us today. He's a producer with Frontline, and his latest effort is called The Choice 2016. This is a dual biography of presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. It's premiering tonight on WHRO TV 15 at 9 o'clock. Mike Weiser, nice to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate the work that you're doing in this, because you're really looking at the narratives and the stories that have shaped these candidates and brought them to this point. And we might think, my goodness, is there's nothing else we could possibly learn about these people. But that's not the case.
That's right. You have two candidates here who've been in the headlines for the last year and actually have both been public figures for decades. And I think there is a feeling amongst a lot of people that they know these two individuals. But what we set out to do in the film was to really understand who they are, where they come from, and why they act the way that they do, so that when you see the two candidates, for example, on the debate stage, that you can understand the life stories that they have that led them to this point. And from people who've seen the film, certainly for my part on working on it, there was a lot of insight and new ways of understanding who these two are.
I think it's very interesting to think about the fact that in this media-saturated environment, where we certainly do have a fair number of data points, we don't necessarily find out what people's stories are. And it's those stories that really powerfully shape who they are. They propel us through our lives. They influence the way we would deal with issues. And so I wonder if you can give us a slight preview, maybe of each of the candidates and something you discovered in this process that you didn't know before.
Absolutely. I think for both of them, we start with the candidates at the very beginning, inside the homes where they were raised. And you start even then to get a sense of just how different these two candidates are. Donald Trump was raised, his father, Fred, was a developer who instilled in the family a belief that there are winners and there are losers in the world. And he taught his children that they had to be killers. And that is a worldview and a philosophy that Donald Trump carried with him through the rest of his life. In fact, one of the biographers who we spoke to who interviewed Trump said that Trump told him that he didn't believe he had changed since he was in first grade. And in first grade, he had a reputation of being a bit of a troublemaker, somebody who would say what he wanted and was, in Donald Trump's view, was a winner. Hillary Clinton's story is a very different one, whereas I think the early Trump is one that has obvious parallels with the Donald Trump that you see today. Hillary Clinton underwent a number of transformations, the most obvious being a political transformation. She began her life, her dad was a supporter of Goldwater. She was a Goldwater girl. And one of the things we explore in the film was how she was shaped by the 1960s and by the changing of the time as her politics changed, and how the year 1968 really personally changed her, watching Martin Luther King assassination, Robert Kennedy, and then actually traveling with her friend Betsy Ebling, who we spoke to go see the Democratic Convention where all of the protests and violence were going on. And she really came to believe the older generation had failed and her generation had a role in changing things. Donald Trump was not affected by those years of the 1960s. So it's really fascinating to go back and see the early years of these two candidates, where they came from and how it shaped them.
And it's all going to be taking shape tonight at 9 on WHRO TV 15. Mike Weiser, thanks for telling the stories. They're really, really important. And I always think if you talk to people, you know their stories, it really helps you understand how they move in the world. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Mike Weiser is a producer with Frontline, and his latest effort is called The Choice 2016. It's a dual biography of presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump that premieres tonight on WHRO TV 15. Let's go to Dave on the line from Williamsburg. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hey, hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I was out breakfast this morning, and there's a bunch of people, and we're all older, and we're white and so forth, and mixed political backgrounds. And the feedback was that Trump started off attacking and so forth and then just went downhill for the rest of the thing. And at the very end, there was one lady who summed it up. She said, "I changed my vote last night when he attacked Clinton essentially for not being presidential and not having stamina." And she said, when Clinton replied, her words were, "She ate him alive." And then, and she said, Trump compounded his mistake by, at the very end, saying, "I could have gone after your family, but I didn't." And I said, "Yeah, I heard that." And she said, "That convinced me that he was not fit."
Wow.
That was what I picked up on this thing. And this is from a lady that was a hardcore gated community Republican. And she said, "No way." And I said, "Well, who are you going to vote for?" And she said, "The woman."
Wow. Wow. Dave, thank you for the call. That's a really interesting point. And Professor, I know that there has been a lot of conversation about that interchange and those interchanges.
Well, that's correct. You know, actually, I would tell your caller, I took notes on the debate, and I have recorded that as my personal opinion, the best moment of the debate for Hillary Clinton. Certainly, when she responded to his critique about stamina, and as your fellow breakfast mates might have pointed out or noticed, you know, it was ironic that he was talking about stamina, because for many viewers who are not necessarily seeing it through a partisan lens, it was clear that he was running out of steam through about halfway on through the debate. She did make mincemeat of him. That is definitely the soundbite moment of hers from the debate.
Maddie's on the line from Williamsburg. Hi, Maddie. You're on the air.
Hi. I am, well, I'm a Hillary Clinton voter, but I did hear Donald Trump say one thing I was hoping you guys could clarify, kind of follow the gun control, sensible gun laws issue. And it seemed to me when he was talking about security that he said that he and the NRA are in support of not giving guns or not allowing people on the watch list and the no-fly list to have guns. Did I mishear that, or is there going to be fallout for him on that?
You heard that correctly. And I would assume, I haven't had an opportunity to go look at the fact-checking websites, but I would assume that that's going to be one of the statements that comes up on them or would not withstand scrutiny. For Mr. Trump himself, that, you know, he may well be in favor of expanding the terrorist watch list to include, you know, prohibiting purchase of firearms. But I am relatively certain that the NRA put quite a lot of pressure on Congress to avoid that legislation, you know, 6 or 7 months ago when it was being considered.
Thank you for the call, Maddie. I appreciate it. We're at 4 minutes before the hour. Wynn, I think, is going to wrap us up from Chesapeake today. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Kathy. Thanks so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was on the fence going into this debate. I was a Bernie supporter going into the nominations, and I wasn't really happy with either of, you know, the candidates that have been selected. And last night I was hoping to get some clarification, but I found myself both repulsed by both candidates at certain moments, but also drawn to some of their arguments at various moments as well. And so to use a caller's analogy from earlier, in a world of apples and oranges, I'm still craving grapes, and there's just nothing. And so I'm hoping maybe the next two debates will help clarify that a little bit.
When you say you hope the next two debates will help clarify that, are there particular issues that you are most concerned about? Or are you trying to make a decision between another third-party candidate and a Democrat or a Republican?
I think that the next two debates will either push me towards the third party or will cement me with one of the current candidates. I'm really hoping that I will either earn Hillary will either earn some trust from me, or Trump will actually show me that he knows what he's talking about when he's talking about policies and things like that.
All right, Wynn, thank you for the call from Chesapeake. I think Wynn's probably summed up the sense of many undecided voters at this moment.
Yeah, I think perhaps, you know, he's a smaller subset of the undecideds that would consider a third party and or either Clinton or Trump. I think we have much more common for the undecideds a situation where, you know, undecideds, you know, moderate Republicans or lean Republican independents are trying to decide to vote for Trump or Johnson or Clinton. And in the other case, whether, you know, for Democrats, independents that lean Democratic between Clinton and the Green Party ticket.
And I'm just curious about this because you said, you remember our earlier caller that you said we could probably bring public pressure to put the other folks. Do you think those third party as an individual, do you think those third party candidates should be on that stage, or do you think it's appropriate to have a threshold of support to be part of those debates?
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan of not responding to situational, you know, things. So they, you know, in this case, we've got a pretty viable third party candidacy in terms of the Libertarian ticket. And that's really a product that a great deal of Republicans and young people are uncomfortable with the two party nominees. Okay. But that's not going to happen all that much. And, you know, although our Virginia poll put Johnson at 15%, Virginia, very military state and military tend to poll heavy for libertarians, nationally, he's not been able to crack 10%. So I'm probably not a fan of changing that.
All right. Fair enough. Professor, thank you so much for being with us. Professor Rachel Bitticofer is a lecturer and director of CNU's Survey Research Lab at Christopher Newport University. Coming up next on 89.5, it's the Thomas Jefferson Hour. And tonight on WHRO TV 15 at 8, it's the Contenders 16 for 16, talking about the former governors of Massachusetts, Michael Dukakis and Mitt Romney. And then at 9, that frontline program we told you about, talking about where the candidates came from and the stories that shaped them. We'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening.